Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Thanks for joining us, as always, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Jared Alexander, author of Volunteers, Growing Up in the Forever War, published by Algonquin, and it'll be released on November 9th. Volunteers is a book about war, but not just about war. It's about a boy and a man whose early youth and manhood are regulated, if you will, by competing ideas. And remember, the definition of intelligence is the ability to hold competing ideas in your head at the same time. The ideas are, is war necessary? Is it something to long for? Is it an opportunity to kill with impunity? Is it necessary for mankind due to like hardwiring? And can your opinion change? And if so, why? You know, is Lee Greenwood's song, I'm Proud to Be an American, an anthem? Or like a call to arms and a fascist reminder that patriotism, which Einstein said was an infantile disease like measles, is something we should cherish as we watch Jared's beloved and abhorred fighters fly overhead at the Super Bowl to manic cheering by 80,000 people who would gladly beat the crap out of anyone wearing a turban or hijab. If I was Iraqi, I wouldn't take my kids to a sporting event, and even increasingly so as our times get more and more divisive. In any event, the book is about evolution, evolution from boy to man, and in my opinion, evolution from an indoctrinated child to a thinking and rational man. Could be wrong. Anyway, welcome, Jared, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks, Sam. I appreciate that. That was a great introduction. I liked it a lot.
So first things first, I guess, and you know, I don't want to do like Terry Gross questions, but I mean, first things first, why did you want us to know about your life and times?
I just found myself in a position where the war stories that I had been reading were missing a mark to a degree. And that isn't an indicator of their quality. There's some really great literature about war and from a variety of places. But I felt like they, for example, I read The Things They Carried and I read James Webb and I read other authors, Norman Mailer or Ernest Hemingway when I was a teenager. And on the more anti-war side, even on the more anti-war side, they had a tendency to engage my interest and make me want to go and do similar things than they did or experience, have similar experiences they did. And I thought that that was, I didn't know if that was unusual to me, maybe me specifically, but then I began asking questions of friends of mine and they had similar experiences. I mean, as a veteran, I grew up in the 90s and the 80s as a kid, and I was kind of saturated with the military. I was a child of it, but I was also just sort of ensconced in its trappings to a large degree. The Persian Gulf War is a great example of that. You talk about Lee Greenwood. You talked about Lee Greenwood a moment ago, and I mean, he was ubiquitous in 1991. But so were the images of fighter jets and infantrymen charging across the desert and you know, bombs dropping on Iraqis. And that became a sort of lodestar in a way. And I wanted to explore that. I wanted to explore the sort of the building of an American soldier to a degree, or just a soldier in general term, because I don't know if it necessarily is specific to the United States. I think it may exist elsewhere and just maybe in altered forms. I mean, you could probably find examples of this in Homer, but that was the genesis of it, I think, to a large degree. I also wanted to write about the Marine Corps. Very similar to, let's say, If I Die in a Combat Zone by O'Brien. I was really motivated by that. Tobias Wolff's In Pharaoh's Army is another good example. So I kind of wanted to find a way to merge those two together into one, both a story about my experiences in the war, which were not unusual, but I found them to be, I was able to find bits and pieces of it that were, I thought were worthy of discussing, like taking photographs of enemy combatants or taking photographs of bombs going off. I saw that ad infinitum, you know, Marines would, oh, look, a bomb's gone off. I got to get my camera and shoot a photograph of that. And I thought that was odd. And just, it said a lot about the way we were thinking about war. And I wanted to explore that. And then I wanted to bring my childhood into that, because I think that as most people who are fighting in wars were younger. It's a younger activity. It's for young adults, typically, 18 to 22, 23. And there's an excitement to it that I wanted to kind of tap on a little bit and maybe make a statement about it and say, look, maybe there's more to war here than a political binary, either for or against, that maybe there's a nuanced position that the human being takes as it relates to it.
Yeah, and you punctuate the book with some really cool epigraphs, which reminds me, as a bookseller, hold up your book, because everyone judges a book by its cover. And that's a picture of you as a kid, or it, yeah, right?
That's a Marine. I was a sergeant in the Marine Corps in this photo, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, like, one of the epigraphs is William Styron's, "We each devise our means of escape from the intolerable." And, you know, that's not necessarily related to being a soldier or war. But I know authors, you know, they choose their epigraphs with care. Because, you know, I always think it's like the outside of a jigsaw puzzle box, where you see the whole picture, but inside mm-hmm. is your book with all the little pieces put together. And I got lots of little pieces I can ask questions about. So we'll go through a couple of them. But why did you pick that one in particular? I couldn't tell whether it was from your youth, when you were like, you really wanted to do this, or from, I don't know, where was it from? What time? Well,
I think that's it comes from, that quote was, I wanted to tether that a little bit to my father, who, if I remember this, the context of the that chapter and the relationship to it, I wanted to point to a sort of a desperation to get away from an event or get away from a current status that you find somewhat, you know, either on a very simple level intolerable, or on a very complex, you know, a draconian level of discomfort or intolerability. You know, I think in the context of that, I was being bounced around a little bit in childhood, or especially as a teenager. You know, I'd had some, my relationship with my family as a teenager was not the healthiest. It wasn't unusual, I would say, but it definitely, you know, it prompted me to want to go live with my father. And my father, I came to find him in California, very dissatisfied with his life. And he made decisions in that moment that were probably a little self-serving at times, but I was also making, I think, to a certain degree, also making decisions about my time in the military along those same lines, about joining the military, why I was doing it. It was, I make mention in a later piece about, I don't know if I was fighting, if I was enlisting for the country or for myself. And I think that, and to a certain degree, part of me enlisting in the military was getting away from a sense of boredom or a sense of dissatisfaction with my life as it stood in that moment.
It's interesting in the beginning. First, I was confused. Then I kind of understood about your stepfather and your father. And it almost seemed like you considered both of them like your fathers.
That's right.
And, yeah. And that was really interesting. Your stepfather, you know, was Air Force, and he was, you know, and you were right there on the base. And again, like I talked about in the introduction, you're seeing these fighters and maybe affecting your hearing later on. We could talk about that too. But, you know, so you, at the beginning, I mean, your stepfather was, you know, like, he was a Delta kind of guy when you go through those, you know, he was a regular guy, a normal guy, kind of helps make the world go around, takes care of things day by day for people like me, kind of taciturn. And, but at the same time, he seemed to be loving in an interesting way, even though he was quiet.
Yeah, he absolutely was. I mean, I think that fatherhood is just as much of an action as it is a biological, you know, as a lineage. And he filled the role. I mean, you know, my parents divorced when I was about 3. And then I lived with my father for a year, and then my mother remarried in that period. And I came back to live with my mother. You know, he was there, and he just naturally filled the role. And it wasn't it didn't appear to be a hard process for him. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that his own father was very, you know, his own father was very similar, had very well-defined values and moral sets. And but he was also very playful. He understood how to take the air out of the tire, so to speak, in a pressured situation. He knew how to bring levity to harder times. Yeah, he just, But you're right in that he's kind of part of a generation of Americans that you know, made the clocks run on time effectively, you know, at least as far as his world was concerned. He took pride in it, certainly, but it wasn't something he championed or necessarily, you know, paraded. You know, he doesn't, even to this day, he very rarely ever wears anything Air Force related. There are no medals in the house hanging on the wall. There are no plaques of any kind. Well, that's not true, there are, but he doesn't really advertise his service all that much at all. It's very much a, look, this is just what I do for a living. This is kind of my life, and this is what I've chosen to make of it. And I'm going to do it to 100% of my ability. And then, you know, the rest of it is going to be sort of up to you to decide what to think of that. And I admire that to a certain degree. I think that it's really admirable, and it's old in our country, I think, too. So it's somewhat, maybe even a cliche at points, but I do think it's necessary.
Yeah, it's interesting because not only do you have these offshoots with your father who came in and out of your life, but seemed like a lot of fun, and some of the things he did were fun, but like you said, he was dissatisfied with his life in general, wanted to move around. But then it's interesting that one offshoot chapter where you go off and you seem really fascinated by your lineage, which you never knew.
Right.
And that was really interesting, and how it all tied to the military too.
Right. Yeah. You know, we talk about that to this day. My father he's lightened up some on his approach to discussing his father who abandoned him. My uncle has always been very open about it. We talk about it quite a bit, and we have talked about it. And you know, that's a man who I would love to have known more, if only to understand his faults. Like, I can surmise, and I do. I make a lot of assumptions, quite frankly, about the kind of individual he was based on his behaviors toward his three sons who he abandoned. Quite, you know, there's no other way to put that. It's effectively what he did. I mean, you know, he lived, a few hours drive on the other side part of the state. And I don't think he spent more than a few hours, every few years with them, if at best. There was no child support given out and that sort of thing. But I am still very much interested in the ramifications of that, because, you know, I think that there's a ripple effect to that. And I think that, it creates a chain reaction of events that I think I even probably feel in myself even now. You know, it had some real ramifications to my family that I think that things like that need to be explored. And I try to do a little bit of that, especially the anger side of it. That was it was very deep with my father for a long time. I couldn't carry it. I didn't feel it was my water to carry when I was younger. It was one of these sort of situations where I didn't know anything else. So I would be getting mad at something that I just wasn't really part of the lexicon of my life. So it was more just about discovery and exploration of that. Where I started to get emotional about it was when I realized that they knew who we were. They knew who I was. Like, I talk about in the book calling, this man named Jim. And Jim knew exactly who I was when I introduced myself to him. I had never spoken to the man before. I'd never seen him. But he knew that I was out there. He knew that my uncle's children were out there, but he had never engaged with them. And that spoke to me about a set of values that were flawed. And that's when I started to, as I processed and analyzed it, that's when I began to get a little more emotional about it. And I do talk about that too. I hope that answers your question, but the ripple effect of that is something that I'm really interested in exploring. And I do though, so there, and I wouldn't put it past me to do it again, quite frankly.
Now, going back to you and your childhood and that epigraph about a separate piece by John Knowles, where you go, there was no harm in taking aim, even if the target was a dream. And when you were a kid, like, you were a soldier of a kind, and you wanted to be around anything that was like war, like a pretend war, with your friends, with joining cadet groups, with fake medals and things like that. And, you know, to be blunt, it seemed like you were interested in the idea, the possibility of killing people.
I don't know that I was interested in the idea of killing people. That was never part of the lexicon, or never part of the tapestry of that experience. It was a ramification of the experience. It was more interesting to me to survive it. Being under, one of the things I pantomimed a lot with my friends was, being under artillery and mortar fire, which is a completely reactive act. You were defensive. You were sort of helpless in that, quite frankly. And it is not a transactional activity. So the idea of killing people was definitely not part of the landscape there. And I've talked about this with veteran friends of mine, a good friend of mine, Pierce, in fact, we had this similar conversation. And he said, look, it was never really, who was on the other end of the barrel was somewhat meaningless. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we disliked their policies or felt them inhuman. It was not that at all. It was just that they happened to be in the lexicon of, or in the tapestry of our history, or the sort of arc of our history, they happened to be the person that was shooting us in that moment. But it could have been anybody, and it could have been replaced by anyone. It was the experience itself that mattered, not who was providing it. I state that to a degree. I toward the end of the book, I state that, yeah, you know, the world is eventually going to provide me. It was eventually going to provide me the war. You know, I just had to effectively show up to it. You know, and that's what happened. I enlisted in the Marine Corps, and on a long enough timeline, the world sort of delivered the thing that, you know, I had enlisted for. I put myself in a position, and the world just kind of took care of the rest, for better or worse. And you can look through our history, you can look through world history, and find that to be true, I think, just in a number of cases, or, you know, a blizzard of cases, quite frankly.
But you wanted to be on the ground. You didn't want to be in the air, mm-hmm, right?
That's true, yeah. And my interest changed. It was, you know, when I was, you know, interested in as a kid, the fighter jets were what motivated me by virtue of their existence in my world and how loud they, not, no pun intended, but how loud they were. They were everywhere in my environment. As that environment changed, and as my awareness grew, my interest changed. You know, I grew up watching, you know, Platoon. I mean, I saw that when it came out, you know. Hamburger Hill was another one of note of that period that I remember. I watched a lot of those war films, and I empathized with the soldiers in those films. I wanted to be Chris Taylor, I suppose, if you know the character from Platoon, the Charlie Sheen character. That was an interesting archetype to me, to be at the leading edge of history, so to speak, and coming through that, presumably wiser. And I would say that that's true, but it's, I don't know how much that, you know, I don't know if it's worth the cost of it. So, yeah, but the idea of being a soldier while shooting and potentially killing enemy combatants is part of that job. The people who are motivated by simply killing people, it's usually really apparent very soon. And they tend not to be there very long. Now, that said, you know, the act of being in war and the act of being shot at by somebody does produce some very visceral emotions. That's reflected fairly well in art and literature. And it, you know, I demonstrate that to a certain degree in the work. I come across Marines who have deleterious opinions of Iraqis. You know, I think of, or they have very clinical feelings about the job that they're doing as it relates to human beings. You know, I think about the captain who called in an airstrike, the sort of, you know, sidled up to the roof and called in an airstrike and then sort of disappeared into the ether. And then we were sort of left with the aftermath of that. Or the man I meet who brags effectively, quite frankly, about killing a civilian in Afghanistan, or the explosive ordnance disposal Marine who has to go in and do something unfortunate to a suicide bomber who failed to complete his task. You know, there is a dehumanizing aspect to conflict. Part of that is a defense mechanism. But I also think that part of it is very Achilles-like. And I think that that's definitely worthy of exploring. And the fact that we have the capability of doing that is probably should be looked at in its face a little more sternly.
Yeah, it's interesting, those two stories about, you know, the guy tells the boy to bring back the gun. He brings back the gun and then he kills him.
Right.
The second one would be, you know, like the suicide bomber, and he's under the rubble and he's still alive. You know, what are you going to do with him? Kill him. And, you know, then you guys are saying, and you joined in it, you know.
I certainly did. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, it's those things. I mean, oh, and the other thing that's really cool is like when you're really in danger, and I've been through this a couple of times, and you giggle. And that's interesting because you know you could die any moment. But there's something about it that, like, One time I thought I was going to be killed in a thunderstorm because I was climbing on a metal beam in a building that I wanted to get off of. Mm. And another time some guy had a knife to my throat and I went like, go ahead, go ahead, do it.
Wow.
And wow. I was thinking I was like Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon. And I figured if I acted crazy, he wouldn't do it. And we kind of became friends. But yeah, isn't that funny how that happens? And why does it happen?
Yeah, I think that sort of taps on that thing that I'm interested in the most about human behavior in that context. When I first came under actual mortar fire, like pointed, I was sitting on the wrong side of a Humvee and I had to get out and run around the back of this thing. It wasn't very far, you know, it's just around the tailgate of this Humvee and get on the other side so this lieutenant could get access to these radios by virtue of how they were strung up in the truck. And I remember running around and I had my flak jacket open, kind of, you know, unkempt in a sense. And I remember in the chin straps were bouncing off my chin and I'm hearing those rounds land. And the experience of that is kind of, it's very, you can feel it kind of in your rib cage. The concussion passes through your body and it made me laugh. And I talk about it a little bit in the book. Part of it was just the feeling of it inside, like, oh wow, so that's what that is. Because it was answering a lot of questions for me in that moment. That's what that feels like. Whoa, okay. and then the absurdity of this sort of situation and me having to kind of do this mad dash around the back of a truck for you know, silly reasons. And it put to, I this is where I have probably my stepdad in me in a lot of ways, and my dad to a degree too. I was able to see the absurdity of that moment and laugh at it right away. That doesn't necessarily make me brave or maybe even crazy, but it was definitely like, okay, this is my first taste of this. And I'm doing something that looks absurd and just nonsense. And laughter was what came out of my lungs. And I'm very grateful for that. Cause it helped me, I think, get a little bit of confidence in knowing how I would respond under those situations. Cause that's always a question you have. Like, if I'm being shot at by somebody with intent to potentially hurt me, how do I respond to that? Like, you know, like, I don't think you were seeking to have a man put a knife to your throat. Who would? But having the ability to look down, look at that and make a line from Lethal Weapon, which is, that's fantastic. I think that that says a lot about your character. And I think that says a lot about your ability to read the moment. I think that, you were able to see it and intuitively understand something about that moment that kind of widened your, maybe gave you a little bit of a moment to kind of quiet the primal fear you might've had in that moment as well. And I think that's a really valuable tool. It's a really valuable tool.
Yeah, finding humor in things really does make life easier, even if other people don't understand or are appalled by your behavior. And I don't really give a shit. Yeah, and the other thing, this is, well, it's not off topic, is you describe sounds really well, like the bullets going by and the one part where you talk about like, it sounded like the universe was rending. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. Talk a little bit, I know readers will be interested in this, and then also how the sound comes after, you know what I mean? After you see the explosion. So, but yeah, talk about those sounds because they really are like they seem like they really are important to you.
Yeah, they really were because they provided a sense of the surreal. In the context of the bomb falling, you know, I remember that sound will still kind of run a hammer at my spine, you know, sort of like a xylophone. It's one of these sounds that, you know, you the captain's communicating with this pilot and you know he's up there and you can kind of hear the jet. You know, he's sitting at 10, 15, 20,000 feet and maybe a little under that. And he's just kind of, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he had coffee up there, just kind of going through the day before he lands. And, you know, he toggles a bomb loose off the rack and you hear nothing. You hear none of this. But then eventually you start hearing that bomb come down and it sounds like a cosmic rip effectively. And then there's this kind of, then you don't even hear it hit. You just see it. You see the geyser go up. you know, the column of smoke and dust and debris. And then there's a pause. And then depending on how far away you are, then you hear it. And you can sometimes even see that sound wave coming at you. If there's enough humidity in the air, you can see it coming toward you. It's a weird feeling to know that that's happening. And you don't feel it, you just hear it. If you're closer, the closer you are, the higher likelihood you'll feel that, you know, because it has a concussive effect. But if you're further away, it dissipates, but the sound registers. It's almost like thunder, you know, the lightning strikes, then you hear the thunders. It's no different than that. Sound takes longer to travel than light does. The bullets, you know, are somewhat similar to that. I mean, they have different sounds and different pitches depending on how far away you are and what your angle is to the projectile. And if it's very close, it sounds like somebody cracking a bullwhip, and it's a unnerving sound. But if you're, you know, I was very grateful that I was able to pay attention to that. Part of that with the Marine training helped me with that. And when you go through rifle ranges, you're put into a position where you have to lower and raise targets basically in a bunker. And rifle fire is going on overhead. So you get accustomed to that sound to a degree. So you know what to listen for. And it's, yes, but even then it was still kind of, you know, you would hear the sound of the AK and the way it sounds at distance. Sounds very different from what it sounds up close. One of the most awkward, you know, strange sounds was rockets firing out of a helicopter. It had this sort of odd effect of being in opposite of each other. The rocket would sound, then you would see it go out. And it was just really bizarre to watch. And I think that combat is a lot more sound than it is sight. You can't see bullets flying through the air. You're lucky if you catch a rocket at all. I saw maybe the blur of that bomb landing, but you hear an incredible amount of detail. You hear a lot. You know, there's people talking, there's yelling going on if it's particularly intense or loud. You know, it's a soundscape. It really is. It's a very violent soundscape. You know, they talked about this in the Civil War, where you could be two or three acres away of woods between you and the gun that was firing and not hear it. But that same gun could be heard 4 miles away in a nearby town. There was a sort of strange ghosting effect to the sound of war. It exists in places and not in others. It's really surreal. It's hard to describe more than I already have, but it's an incredibly surreal experience.
Yeah, it's funny. I jump around a lot and I apologize for that.
That's all right.
But the expression "get some," which I, you know, is in all the movies, has been one of the most objectionable and I would say obscene phrases that I've ever experienced in my life. That and "boorah" too, and listening to even Kramer do it on Squawk Box or CNBC. Something about those things seem to, especially "get some," it's like, okay, I'm ignoring the fact that what I'm saying is kill as many people as you can. It distills it into something that sounds like you're, you know, cheering for a football team.
Well, there's a little bit of that. There's also a sexual aspect to it.
Really?
Yeah, there's a not in the sense that they're having a sexual thrill in the moment, but there's a conquest aspect to it. I mean, it is hyper masculine, very much. That language is incredibly hyper masculine, and so it's, which has a natural sexual component to it, right? You know, I mean, we think about, you know, part of our culture is sort of steeped with a lot of, you know, think of like your stereotypical frat boy to a certain extent, or somebody who pursues women sort of, you know, almost to the points of absurdity and probably in an embarrassing ways. You know, notching your belt, if you will, it's analogous to that. There's a direct connection between Eros and Thanatos, sex and death. Those two things kind of play off each other and work with each other in a lot of ways. And that's very true for combat. That's very true.
What's funny, it's like Robert Duvall in Apocalypse Now saying, you know, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, or George C. Scott saying, God, how I love this. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was saying in the introduction too. Do you think it's kind of hardwired? I mean, the whole idea of aggression in the first place is necessary. Otherwise, you're probably going to die. And so do you think it's hardwired? And that's part of the reason why, not as an excuse, but as a rationale for, you know, there's always war.
I think it's a thesis. I think it's the opening to a conversation about humanity, to agree. And that sounds probably a little, that sounds a lot more, you know, high-minded than I intended it to be, but it really is. I think it's a window into something we need to probably explore further. I do. I think it's hardwired into us. I mean, if we go back far enough, one, you know, we could probably find, you know, one tribe bonking the head of another tribe with a bone over a patch of water. You know, I mean, this is, and they were not likely engaging with a sense of self-reflection to wonder what if that was a bad thing to do. I do think this is hardwired. We are hard. There is a sense of tribalism in human beings. The on our best day, we tend to fight back against it and recognize common good and that sort of thing, and recognize that violence is not a means to an end. It should be the last resort, not the first. But, and yet, despite the best intentions of our, despite all of our good intentions, we still fight wars and we still ask for them. I mean, I state that a little bit in talking about the beginning of the second Iraq war, you know, the opening of the 2003 invasion. You know, there was a subset of American population who was against it, but there was a lot more that was for it. And the polls showed that. And that means that there were people from all across the country who were okay with the notion of invading another country on suspicion, quite frankly. And obviously there was a little bit of obfuscation of information to that, that contributed to that. You know, yeah. Colin Powell, you know, Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney did not do us a big favor there.
I feel so bad about Colin Powell, you know, dying. His funeral, I think, is today, maybe today. But in any event, you know, when they made him say yellow cake and he trusted them. And, you know, the whole thing is Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. That's right. The weirdest thing. That's the weirdest fucking thing. And yeah, it's just, you know, it's funny when you said that about two tribes, it reminded me of the beginning of 2001. It's the monolith. It kind of gives us an excuse. It's the monolith that's letting the guy see, hey, the bone, here's what I can possibly do with the bone. But yeah, you're completely right about that. But then, you know, there's, again, jumping around, there's these people you describe that are honorable. And there's a lot of tears too. Like, talk about, instead of me talking about it, talk about Rebel Six.
Rebel Six, the commanding officer of the battalion that I was attached to. The first thing I had to say about him is that he was a consummate professional. Like, he is the embodiment of everything that we try to produce in a combat Marine or a combat soldier, especially a leader. And I don't mean to say that to whitewash him into some sort of, you know, patriotic binary, because I don't think that that's a fair statement or a fair thing to do to him. There was a Colonel Kilgore in him, if you know, from Apocalypse Now. There very much was one, you know, I mean, you could see that, and the men loved it. I mean, Kilgore is a real person. I mean, that was a, you know, that kind of archetype exists, and Rebel Six filled that to a large degree. He was an intelligent individual. He was incredibly bright. He knew his job better than anybody else in his unit. He knew exactly what he needed to do and how to do it. And in a local sense, he was effective. Now, how that translates to the larger strategic picture, it's not as, I'll put it this way. The area that we operated in, I think, was under ISIS control until just recently. After, you know, when ISIS grew and spread down the Euphrates, it was, you know, if you look at satellite photos of the base that I was stationed, it's been cratered by our bombs. So on a larger strategic sense, I don't know how effective our efforts were there. But on a local level, his efforts were incredibly effective and his ways of approaching it. And I think we need people like that. And we need Marines and we need soldiers and we need pilots and wing commanders. And we need people who can do those jobs. I firmly believe that, still do. What I would like to see is somebody who understands what it means to employ that individual, you know, and this requires some civic leadership that does this based on the way our government's structured.
It's interesting when you, when there's that tragic situation and he gets up to talk and you say, this is very well done. As you say, there was this one quaver in his voice, but there weren't any tears. There wasn't anything else. It was just one, maybe he thought, slip, where he evidenced the fact that there was some emotional component for him.
Well, I saw that too in another context. That was, and I wrote about it. It's when we lost a Marine to an IED that was very popular in the unit. And he was, you know, I described that in detail with intent. And I watched Rebel 6 come out of that command post and deflate onto a camping stool.
Yeah.
Like I stood 6 feet from him, and which was an unusual position for me to be in, and him. You know, he was in charge of a 1,000 some odd man task force, and I was a sergeant who was attached to him to sort of observe his operation effectively and participate in it to a degree. And we had this sort of strange connection in that moment that I still question a lot of it, you know, and I do in the book, and it was really, you didn't see the commander in that moment. You saw a man who just lost somebody very dear to him and him struggling very hard to deal with that emotionally. The at the end, when he gives his speech, that was it. I think that his emotion there was a swell of pride. He was incredibly proud of his men, and he had right to be. I mean, those guys did an incredible job for the task they were given, and under the difficulties of that occupation. And I think that that's what that was at the end. It was just simply an unchecked moment of incredible pride for those people.
Yeah, it's interesting. It reminds me of the situation where you talk about when they're reading off, when they're calling names, and then they go present, present, yeah. And then they call a name. It's almost like a ritual. And there's no answer. They call it again. They call it again, and then everyone realizes this is someone who gave up his life. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, that was poignant. And that's all. Well, of course it is. That's all true, right? That's how you do it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'd been to a number of those. I'd been to one. That was for the one I wrote about was for the memorial service for the 2nd Marine Division. And then I had done one after my battalion deployment, which was highly emotional. It was a lot of, I mean, I was an emotional mess to a degree. It was a really, but that's what they do. Yeah, that's part of the ritual. It is, you said it perfectly. It is literally a ritual. It is a scripted event to a degree. And part of that is reading those names 3 times. And on the 3rd time, reading the full name as a recognition of the fact that they're gone.
Yeah. And, you know, the idea is whether I believe it or you believe it or not, there's a certain nobility throughout the book. You know, there's a certain nobility. But, okay, let me jump around again. Remember when you wake up and there's that dog there, and then, you know, in the morning you find out there's a whole circle of dogs of protection. But the thing about it is, it seems as if, and I'm laying it on you, you might disagree with me, but it seems as if you had more respect for dogs in some situations than you did for people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, tell me about that.
That's a fair statement. I think that as it relates to the animal itself, the dog was an innocent, you know, the dog was a victim of circumstances, but also, yeah, that's an interesting dichotomy because the human was too, to a degree, right? I mean, the average insurgent, I would say, was probably somebody who just didn't want us in his backyard. And I think that a lot of Americans can, at least a certain subset of Americans could probably relate to that. The irony is that they happen to be the same set of Americans that put us there. And So, but the dogs, yeah, there was, I think that dogs are a representation of boyhood in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, I knew that there were Marines who were adopting dogs. And I'd say, as you know, I wrote about this, you know, Marines were adopting dogs and bringing them into their camps. And the Navy medical teams would have to go around and shoo them off, you know, because they, you know, it could carry disease and that sort of thing. There wasn't like a huge veterinary process there. But yeah, I think that dogs represented a certain innocence in us, and it was, I think they were more interested in, they would sort of spiritually want to preserve that even while also, you know, inflicting great harm on human beings. It's this sort of strange dichotomy of our nature. You know, we will do incredible harm to ourselves, but we'll at the same time also help out in other ways. And that's what I saw a lot of that. You know, I saw a lot of that human to human as well. You know, I witnessed an interview process that a colonel gave to a pair of women who had a mortar round land in their house, and they were looking for restitution for that. I'm sorry, it wasn't a mortar round, it was a bomb. It was an aircraft drop bomb. And the reason why the bomb was dropped was because a mortar tube had been placed in the back of the house by an insurgent force. And they were hoping to claim some money from the coalition or the Iraqi government and the occupation to rebuild their home. And the colonel was like, look, no, sorry. I mean, you guys put an 82-millimeter mortar tube in the backyard of your house and let insurgents fire from it as if they had a choice in the matter, quite frankly, which they did not. So they kind of left empty-handed. And then immediately he turns around and comes with me into an office and describes the absolute misery he's going through trying to get a woman sent home to the United States for surgery.
Yeah.
It was right away. We went from that meeting, and me and that colonel went and had a conversation about that. And it was an emotional conversation. I mean, he was.
It's so weird. Yeah, she had spina bifida. Oh, right. Yeah. What happened? What happened to her? Oh.
He was sent to the U.S. From what I remember, yeah. She was sent to the U.S. From there, I don't know.
And again, not laying stuff off on you, but you said it. I mean, when that guy's in the chair and he's got his hands in his pockets and he won't take them out, you kind of said you wanted to kill him. And then afterwards, you felt small and you thought that people would basically dismiss you for feeling small, but you said you wanted to kill him.
Mm-hmm. In a moment. Yeah. In that moment, I had an interest in it. It was simply out of fear. You know, my concern was he had a way of detonating that house, which was a possibility and what they call a tactics. It was a tactic of the insurgency was to wire their house and then use a cell phone to trigger the mine or trigger the explosive. Command detonated mine or command detonated explosive. And I talk about that a little bit in that section is that, you know, in that moment, my sort of fear and my frustrations with that fear were driving me to behave the way I did. And that was, you know, people have asked me what the toughest section to write. And that was probably it. Because there's a lot of moral questions I have to ask about my own behavior. And I try to do that there. You know, I try to explore that. Like, look, you know, I explain like, look, you know, the entire time that I'm doing this, there's an undercurrent of fear. And the further along I go in this, the more the cracks in the veneer start to show. And I start to see that water starts to come up above the surface effectively. And that was a sort of what I would say a culminating event in that. I'm very grateful, you know, over my actions about what I took, the actions I took there. You know, I think that if I had been a lesser person or maybe even some of the other people I suggest in the book, I might not have acted the same way. We would be having a very different discussion.
Yeah.
But even then I can't give myself a pass. You know, I certainly don't. I can't sit here and say that I didn't have an interest in that moment, you know, shooting him with an M16. You know, I'd fired at other human beings in that war. I'm grateful that I have no idea what, you know, whether or not I hit or wounded or killed any of them, but I know that I had fired at them. You know, I was in a position to do so and did so. And the context, as far as the reaction of the Marines around me, you know, yeah, that was very honest. I feel like if I had voiced what I'd voiced in the book then, I think that I would have been somewhat derided or perhaps looked at as a less than even as far as being a Marine goes.
I have a similar situation that happened to me. Similar, not as dangerous as yours, but I was in a situation where a guy hit me, but around him were all little kids, some of them his relatives, some of them my relatives, grandchildren, his child. And I didn't hit him back. And I wondered whether people thought I was being a coward or whether I was being a coward. And I had no fear. There was no fear. I could hit him back in a minute. And then I thought, you know what? I did the right thing. But I still have doubts about it. And it's kind of like, that's not exactly like that, but you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, and you express that kind of in a way too. Yeah, and I go off. You're supposed to be talking, and I'm talking. But
well, I actually kind of wanted to ask, like, Sam, you had a knife put to your throat, and a man punched you. What's going on in your world? Like, I kind of want to get by you a couple of drinks and talk your ear off about it.
Well, I'm 69 years old, so some shit has to have happened to me in that time period. Plus, I'm kind of an asshole, so I generally attract that kind of behavior. But overall, you know, I think I've. Yeah, there's other ones I could tell you, but it's you, not me. yeah, we could get a drink sometime and go back and forth on it. The other thing is, like, you know, you describe graphically, like, roadside bombs, and like you said about that cool guy, nice guy. But then you also talk about, this is so weird if it actually occurred, the guy's spine coming through, and it's just, his spine, the vertebrae all together coming.
Oh, yeah.
How the hell could that have possibly happened?
I had to conclude it was some hearsay because I heard it secondhand. It was the Lance Corporal was telling me this story but I do know that bomb did go off, and I've read an after action of that and some other people talk about that. And I had heard that story from a couple of other places. So I give it a little bit of truth. I think that there's a nugget of truth to that. Now, I don't know how many Lance Corporals are walking around with an anatomical understanding of the human body enough to where they can look at a vertebrae laying on a wall and be able to describe it. But he did say it. And so he believed it. And that was informing quite frankly, a neurosis in the moment, and an earned one. And I thought that was just like, this man is telling me that he had just had a suicide bomber come through a wall in a truck or a car rather, blow up. And incidentally, no one got killed in that. It was the odds on that happening were not even worth describing and how slim they are, but no one was hurt when that happened. The suicide bomber in a vehicle came through a wall, blew himself up, hurt no one. And the Marine that I saw was there, the Marine that I interacted with who was there, described this thing to me. This man's vertebrae laying on the side of a wall, laying on a wall and on the ground. And it was almost like it stung the man into some sort of reboot cycle, because he kept thinking, you know, he was saying Allahu Akbar over and over again and repeating that. But he was kind of like, he didn't have the same look. I don't know if you know the picture or not, but it's a very famous photograph of a Marine in Way City, Vietnam. He's got a mustache and he's holding a rifle and he's just staring into the camera and there's nobody home. It's a very famous photograph.
Yeah, I do.
And it makes me think of that. The Marine that I saw wasn't that way. He was interacting and he was communicative and he was, you know, he was aware of himself and others. But there was this kind of like wild-eyed to him, you know, like a wild eye to him a little bit. Like he, you know, what you might, you know, what Michael Hare might say, you know, he really, he you know, had really seen beyond, you know. And that I thought was, to a degree, what I expected to see over there, but it was never quite in the way that I expected. It was very, almost not cheery, not as if he was happy he saw this thing, but just like amazement and just kind of startled over the fact that this is what his life was in that moment. Like, I have witnessed this thing occur. And then, there's no way that I can ever fully explain it. So I'm just gonna do the best I can with everybody I see.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's phenomenal. But you know, that section is interesting because all those guys telling stories, sitting around telling stories about graphic killings and stuff like that. And it's almost as if you're doing it, as if it was a movie. You know, we've been talking about several movies And it's almost like that.
And yeah, I think that the films, I mean, look, my friends and I, my veteran friends, we kind of tap Platoon a lot. We mine it for the language and the kinds of ways that we, because it's such a great representation of a infantry platoon. It's probably one of the best in existence. And so we kind of, that movie is a big lodestar. It's a huge lodestar in our experience. And, but you're right. I think, you know, getting to where you're at, like the films were hugely, they were just in orbit of us. At least they were to me. I know that. And they were to my friends to a certain extent. Now that doesn't mean we went around quoting them. That said, I did hear the combat correspondent line a lot from Full Metal Jacket. The stuff that with the Baldwin and giving Joker a hard time about being a combat correspondent. I think I had to memorize that just so I was prepared to give the responses to those to those kinds of things. But yeah, I mean the films were definitely in loose orbit of our experience. But I do think that that's probably more true to my generation of the Forever War rather than perhaps the later generations, because you know time marches, as they say, and those films get older and the distance from them grows and they may not have as much of an impact, but they definitely were a huge part of my upbringing. And, you know, they definitely influenced the way that I approached the military at times, for better or worse.
Yeah. When you say Full Metal Jacket, and I was talking about things I can't process and hate, it's like that scene in the plane when the gunner's shooting a line of Vietnamese who he has no idea whether they're good or bad. And they said, how can you shoot children like that? And he goes, you just have to lead them a little
just
bit.
Don't lead them so much. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a real story, by the way. Michael Hare witnessed that in Vietnam.
Really?
And then he took that and that's what became that scene in Kubrick's film.
Wow. I had no idea.
Startling, right?
Yeah. It's difficult to talk about. I mean, you know, like this drone attack that Biden, of all people, allowed, where the military denied for weeks that we had killed them, that there was explosive on the trucks or something like that. And then we said, hey, our thoughts, you know, the usual thing, our thoughts and prayers are with them. Just like, thank you for your service. And you did. I interviewed somebody else who talked about, I've forgotten the name of the book. I wish I could remember it. But yeah, thank you for your service. Which kind of pisses me off. This is horrible. It pisses me off when like I'm the Diamond member, like I'm a big shot of some airline, Delta or American, and the military gets to board before me. And I kind of get pissed off. He's like,
do you really?
Yeah, it's like, thank you for your service. I go, okay, but I'm Diamond. It's horrible.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's funny because that's a newer thing. Because when I was I got bumped off a flight when I came back from Iraq. I got back to the States after, and I got back and I had to go to Raleigh and then fly to Denver. And I got bumped from that flight. I got there and I got to the airport. I was on time, well within the, time frame that I needed to be there. And I get to the gate and they're like, oh, yeah, you've been kicked off bumped off the flight. I'm like, I just literally got back from the, but you know what? I was like, I just stayed the night and got caught the next plane the next morning. So that sort of like performative thank you for being in the military is kind of come a little later in that context. It's been around for a while. Yeah. I know I stated in the book to a degree, the thank you for your service is sort of a something we do. It's almost like an advertisement, it's just saying thank you, we appreciate it. But it's a platitude. It's not even, I kind of wonder if it's lost its meaning to a certain extent.
Yeah. That's what you say. Platitude. I was trying to think of the word. Yeah. Well, as we get to the end of this and I go back to the first question I ask you, when you tell us all of this, I'm learning a lot about you and your evolution. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, what am I supposed to learn or be entertained by in this because at the very end, I can't quite determine whether you, because, you know, you talk about hating the core, and then you talk about, say, your hate was slightly diminished, imperceptibly, almost imperceptibly diminished is what you say. And I'm wondering, okay, well, I came into this thing, I'm through the tunnel, I'm out of it. Where is he now? Was this all horrible? Was it a big mistake? Or do you just still have mixed feelings about the whole thing? Because, you know, I watch you grow up and I see what you're doing, and I watch you in there, and then you're out. And I'm saying to myself, I wonder if Jared hates what he did, whether he has mixed feelings about what he did, or he still is proud of what he did, you know?
I think the question, for me, a lot of it is the question is the thesis of the book. It's that what you're asking is sort of I guess what I came away with is I ended up finding I had more questions than answers. And part of it, one of those is, where do I land? And I think that I state that I don't want to give away the last lines of the book. I'll let the readers get there. But I think that there's a duality to this, and there's a duality to my vision of the military. I mean, I am proud of it, but I also recognize its flaws. I am proud of my time there, but I also recognize my flaws within it, of which there are many. And so that sort of duality is what interests me. It's this sort of, I can live in both spaces at once. It's like you said in the very beginning, the ability to hold two opposing points in your head at the same time and still function, you know. And that's kind of the way I approach how I view it, how I view the military, how I view my time in it, how I view my upbringing around it, is that it is both a love and hate. You know, I hate what it can turn a person into, but I also love what it can turn a person into under a different context. Like a GI in World War II who's very good at killing Germans is not that much different than a GI in Vietnam who's very good at killing Vietnamese. But the moral foundation for each of those is different. So the way we view them is different, right? The killing Nazis in World War II, we have no qualms about. Killing Vietnamese in Vietnam, we have a very different set of variables for. But the attributes are relatively the same. It's just the moral foundations of them are different. And yeah. And so that sort of duality is interesting to me. What we decide is worthy and what we decide isn't. And yeah, I don't want to pass judgment on either one of those. That's not my objective. But
yeah, but you do say when you're still a kid, you say you realize that Vietnam is, it's like an epiphany for you, that Vietnam is the first war we really lost. Mm-hmm. And I just read the other day Ho Chi Minh saying, hey, you can kill 10 of us for everyone we kill of you, and we're still going to win.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And
what does that say about his moral set? He's willing to sacrifice millions of his people to our thousands in order to accomplish his goal. Is that a moral decision? That's a question that I have. I don't think that pursuing Vietnamese independence was a bad idea. I think that was overdue by a margin of a couple of decades by the time we got there. True. But I have questions but it does bring up some questions of ethics and morals. Like, what is the volume of cost worth the sacrifice? What is the volume of sacrifice that's worth the goal? You know, how much do we invest in this? Like, you know, we're upset. I think there's a subset of our populations that are upset about the war in Afghanistan ending or the messy withdrawal from it. But we had really no qualms about the lackluster involvement we had toward it for the 20 years we were there. So it's kind of this strange, there's this sort of mixed, we have this sort of mixed psychology about these wars and how we want to prosecute them and how we want to moralize or understand them.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the title of your book, it's Volunteers, but subtitles are, I always think they're cool because that's what you're really saying.
That's right.
It's the forever war. And when you say forever war, that's an interesting subtitle because you can take it so many different ways.
Right.
To a specific war, to the concept of it's always going to be war. And then, you know, if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's like, okay, what the hell we were thinking. Yeah, in Vietnam, you're talking about the moral imperative. You know, we let 55,000 kids die. And for what? and you talk about the domino theory. And then in Iraq, what exactly was it, since we left there and Afghanistan without actually saying? I remember, you know, normally when we left Iraq the first time, normally they passed the flag and the country or the army that loses acknowledges they lost, but they had one American passing it to another American. There wasn't any victor or loser. Mm-hmm. And that really struck me, you know, where's the people we beat? Where are they? And who are we actually fighting, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. And I, you know, like Iraq has sort of maintained a sort of equilibrium or a precarious equilibrium with our sort of, you know, behind the scenes assistance to a degree. But Afghanistan, I think, is the best case of what you're talking about. I mean, it was literally just a war for the sake of itself to a degree. You know, it existed to serve itself in a lot of ways. It wasn't serving our national interest necessarily. We had neither the will to leave nor the will to actually stay and win it. And so it just became this kind of, you know, below the fold B section kind of conflict that just sort of existed in the backdrop of our daily lives. And we threw money or troops at it whenever it boiled over and needed our attention, but otherwise it just sort of existed as a norm. What interests me is the fact that we allowed that to go, because look, I mean, we own our wars. The Americans own our wars. It may not seem as if we do sometimes, but you know, we elect people who commit us to conflicts. You know, the structure of our democracy is such that we decide where our leaders are, and those leaders take us to places that we want them to go. Or, and if they don't, they need to be removed, replaced with someone else. But since, you know, over the past 20 years, Congress has given up its war powers to the president with the authorized use of military force. I would say that the average American considers the wars in Afghanistan about number 9 or 10 on their list of priorities as far as the country goes. And that says a lot. That says a lot about how we feel about our fighting abroad and how we are projecting ourselves in overseas. And that's worthy of exploration, definitely, especially now that the wars have wrapped up. We have this, we're going to have a moment of time here to sort of dissect this stuff even further. And it's definitely overdue.
You know, it's almost like a still or distillation process, because at the very end, maybe not the very end, you talk about, you know, the bumper stickers and the letters on the rear windshield that basically are saying, you know, war is great. You want to kill. And, you know, I can't remember what did the bumper stickers say? I forgot.
Oh yes. The Marine bumper stickers that the Marines had on their, you know, it was like, I remember one of them was a regarding snipers, don't run, you just die tired. Yeah, there's a lot of these sort of pro-war, pro-Marine, pro-war bumper stickers that you could buy at the mall in Jacksonville, North Carolina. And there was definitely a sort of, it was meant to sort of signal your fealty, you know, and the Marine Corps is a war-fighting entity. And so it was natural and a natural statement to make in that space. I mean, it was part of the language. And those bumper stickers sort of reflect that. Let me see if I can find the one you're talking about. It was a really great one. I think it's worthy of.
Yeah, I had it written down. I've got it right here.
Here we go. Carpenters hammer nails, plumbers fix pipes, and Marines kill people. Another one is give war a chance.
Yeah.
They were like patriotic death threats. So how I describe them. Yeah. There's a real thing. I think we still make them.
Actually, that's a good time to end, because that kind of brings us full circle to a certain extent. And I could ask questions for hours, but let's save that for when we go to get to drink.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm just outside of Philadelphia. If you ever come here or on your book tour or whatever, and come stop by the bookstore. But yeah, any time, it would be great to see you. And I really enjoy talking to you.
You too, Sam. Thanks for doing this.
Okay. All right. Talk to you soon, hopefully. See ya.